Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." We as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. With all that getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things being put in the marketplace all the time. African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening media. Tonight, we're scheduled to have a special guest join us for an interesting conversation, Associate Professor of Political Science at Pennsylvania State University, Dr. Earl A. Henderson, will be with us to discuss his latest book, The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized, Cultural Revolution in the Black Power Era, and some of his other articles that and later publication and earlier publications. I think it'll be an interesting conversation this evening. He also has a new book that's coming out, scheduled to come out this month. I think Brother Richard has the information on that. Either way, we'll be right back after commercial break with our special guest, Professor Earl A. Henderson. We'll be right back.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
China, Wu China. All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started here, and it's 7:14 here in the city of Philadelphia, before we get started here on our program, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I'm looking forward to, interacting with, Dr. Henderson. The whole thing of international relationships is good and is great. And I think it's really important in this time. And what he's been doing, the works he's been doing, I think becomes fundamental in helping us understand, especially those of us in North America, just how the policy that is being implemented, the foundation of the thinking or the theory comes into being. But I do, you have mentioned that the revolution, I like that title that he has for his book, The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized. I'm assuming, because I'm a Gil Scott, devotee, it kind of has its basis. I hope we can, really confirm that out of Gil Scott, the revolution will not be televised. But I'm also interested, and I see it says, and this was done in 2019, but I see it says, Elliot, he has a book either coming out or is out, which is just as relevant to us because of our discussion, Scripture, Shrines, Scapegoats, and Politics.
He might have to double back and come back to the program to discuss that.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, I got that. Let's do it. So I'm looking forward to that, really engaging and, learning from Dr. Henderson.
Our guest this evening is a associate professor of political science at Penn State University, where he teaches international relations. He earned his PhD at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and has authored more than 50 scholarly publications, including 5 books. His latest book, The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized, Cultural Revolution in the Black Power Era. I want to welcome to our program Dr. Earl A. Henderson. Dr. Henderson, are you there?
Yes, sir.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing just fine. How you doing that day, brother?
I'm glad to have you on Time for an Awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing, Dr. Henderson?
I'm doing just fine. How you doing there, Brother Richard?
Oh, great.
Dr. Henderson, before we get involved in the conversation this evening, I want you to clear up a little debate here.
Yes, sir.
Brother Richard said that he think the title of your latest book, the one that's out now, came from a Gil Scott's record. I think it might have been a offshoot of the paper that you wrote, Hidden in Plain Sight. Clear that up for us before we talk about a little bit about some of your work.
Yes, sir. Well, I never missed Brother Gil when he came to Detroit. And I remember one time he started playing a riff, and he said, people always ask me when I'm going to make a new record. And he said, when y'all buy up the old ones, you know? So it's definitely from Gil, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And so Revolution Will Not Be Theorized is a proposition from the Black Power Movement, building on Harold Cruz's work. And my basic premise is that when we organize, the basic premise is this. We're not here because of the good graces of white people. But often when scholars start talking about black activism or revolutions, they'll talk about black folks in all types of capacities, except when they get to the issue of theory. And theory forms your strategy, your framework. And at that point, they often opt for some white theorists. Now, I'm not saying you can't have white theorists. There are many. There are many, and some of them profound. But nobody liked the black theorists, from Du Bois to Anna Julia Cooper, the people who organized, who organized the Underground Railroad, who organized for our liberation, including the slave revolution that brought us freedom in this country. So my argument is that theory should come from the experience of black people and also the strategizing of black folks, the black thinkers, you know. So that's where I'm coming from.
Okay.
You ain't got no argument out of me. That's a good argument.
Dr. Henderson, let me start out like this. I was reading the kind of synopsis of the book, and it says The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized examines black cultural revolution in the U.S. with a particular focus on the Black Power movement. The roots of this phenomenon are in the transformation of slave religion in the context of slave hiring, which motivated the leadership of slave revolts, Gabriel Prosser, Denmark Vesey, Nat Turner, and it culminated in the black participation in the U.S. Civil War. Before we walk our folks up through the history of this, talk about what you mean by the roots of this transformation comes out of slave religion.
Yeah, so this is basically the thesis of Sterling Stuckey, who wrote a book published a book in 1987 called Slave Culture. He just recently passed.
Yes, he had been a guest on our program.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. So the argument is that African-American, black nationalism in particular, and African-American culture emerges from the slave quarters. And part of that was this religious aspect of it. Now, he gets into contestation, if you will, with Wilson Moses, who talks about the origins of black nationalism, but he sees it more in the establishment, for example, of independent black organizations, dated all the way back to Prince Hall in the late 18th century, but the culmination is Richard Allen and right there in Philly in the AME Church. But Stuckey argues, well, that's where elite black culture may emerge, but black culture, the masses of us were enslaved, and we built in that in the tortures of degraded circumstances that we found ourselves in. We still made liberation possible, and we achieved our liberation as well. And much of this is through what we call slave religion, because it was an amalgam of different types of religious impulses. Would it just be lost if you simply reduce it to Christianity or even an indigenous African religion? It was a synthesis of them. And Stuckey in Slave Culture does an incredible job of talking about that. So, for example, the Kalunga. Sometimes people are asked, there's so many crosses in slave quarters, crosses, and people assume they were just Christian. And I'm sure some of them were, but as Stuckey argues, Kalunga is also just picture a regular cross, like the plus sign. And Kalunga represented on one side of the cross, on the horizontal axis now, you go below. And on the other side, when you go across the vertical and then rise again above the other horizontal axis, you are reborn. And that horizontal axis, the x-axis, if you were looking at it mathematically, that was always a water barrier. That's called Kalunga. That comes from Central Africa, you see?
Right.
So it's, to look at it and just think it's a Christian cross, no. But also just to focus on Kalunga and ignore the impact of Christianity is to ignore the extent to which our forefathers and foremothers used what was at their disposal to achieve their liberation, because they were strategists. That's how they organized the Underground Railroad. That's how they even survived. They were not supposed to be 4 million enslaved Africans in 1860. You see, but we survived and thrived in ways that suggest our mental acuity. And again, not because of the good graces of white folks. And if we did, then we strategized and achieved. It wasn't just Harriet Tubman. How'd she know that? How did the enslaved Africans know to go to the Union lines when the Union was already told they would return them? And give reparation, if you will, for the contraband to their slave masters. No, the enslaved Africans transformed the Civil War. And Lincoln even said that. They transformed the Civil War. Lincoln wasn't interested in freeing any slave. But the enslaved Africans were, and Douglass talks about that too. I don't want to go too far ahead, but it comes from this transformation of slave religion. This is an excellent sister named Kelly Jackson. She's got a recent book called, I'm blocking on the title. It's cited in my book, but she looks at the black abolitionists who threatened and used for, yes, sir.
Yeah, she was on with us about a month ago.
Oh, beautiful. They're synthesizing what we have written. And here I mean black folks talking about the strategies we use, the strategies we devised for our liberation. Well, that transformation Du Bois talks about in 1935 in his Black Reconstruction, that there was a transformation in the type of Christianity in the slave quarters. And what he's really talking about is this movement that led Gabriel, Denmark, Vesey, and the good Reverend Nat Turner to use religion in a liberating way. Now my argument is not that if somebody asks me, say, well, brother, is for in this country, is black religion, is Christianity revolutionary? No, religion isn't revolutionary, but that's not the question. The question is, or that's not the issue. The issue is, under what conditions can it be made revolutionary? And that's what our people did, see?
Okay.
It's interesting, because I think we were just having this discussion and you were bringing up Harriet Tubman in relationship to the communication of her going down and people being ready to leave. So it had to be some kind of network. I'm understanding you, Dr. Anderson. It had to be some already network, organized network of information and intelligence in order for that to happen, for them to know what to do, and for her to make sure how to navigate through that hostile territory.
Yes, sir. And we talked about it. We wrote about it. William Webb talks about it. He says we organized these as early as the Piedmont campaign. He's talking about Piedmont and the presidential campaign in 1856. William Webb was a liberated a former slave, and he talks about we set up these networks at 12-mile intervals. Each one was run by what he called a king bee, so they could transmit the information. Even Booker T. Washington talked about what he called, this is where we get it from, the grapevine telegraph, how slaves communicated and built networks. There's a scholar named, and that's where we get it from, heard it through the grapevine telegraph. Booker T. called it. But we had these networks established. There's an excellent book by Anthony Kay, who talks about the networks that slave communities created. And so what you had was these folks who had set up and established an underground that moved the greatest single source of wealth in this country right underneath their master's feet, because we were it. And they moved that in a clandestine network throughout the South and the North. Much of it went north. Some of it went for liberation in Florida. Some of it went to through Mexico. But the lion's share went right up. Your man right there in Philly, William Steele, and the Vigilance Societies, this was set up. We have the records. The Underground Railroad didn't work on no magic quilts. Black folks devised strategies, and we devised programs, and very few white folks were involved. That notion about the white folks, that comes from a book by Alfred Bergston. I think it was written in 1896. During some of the early national campaigns for remembering the Civil War. And Bergston started talking about it. Everybody and their mama, every white person and their mama started talking about they hid slaves underneath in their basements and their cedar. No, the slaves themselves, the liberated slaves, told how they got there. There's an excellent brother down there at Vanderbilt, Bartley, I believe his name is, and he talks about, he has documentation that are liberated formerly enslaved brothers and sisters, the documents they would send their former slave masters. One of them came from Philly. He sent his former slave master. He said he was taking his property, and he wanted to apologize because he also took his horse. Now, the property he was talking about was himself. He said, but you can find your horse at such and such a depot where I left him. Now, of course, the slave master said, aha, now we know where you are, and they sent the slave catchers to get him. The brother was already in Canada. He was told him he was somewhere he wasn't, but the horse was there, at least. We have the documents. We have letters. I'm constantly saying this. You know the old heads used to tell us, the people who won't treat you right won't teach you right. And I'm constantly saying white supremacism will not just teach you what to think. It'll teach you how to think. So I'm talking to folks who can't even imagine that black folks achieved our liberation here through turning what was a battle just to end secession into a revolution to overthrow chattel slavery. Very few, if any, white people, and definitely not in the administration, planned on that or desired that until black folks made that their objective in around 1862-63 during the Civil War. We can document this. But again, white supremacists don't just teach you what to think. It teach you how to think.
Professor Henderson, walking it up through our experience here, you take it all the way up to Malcolm and how Malcolm influenced other movements, the Revolutionary Action Movement, us, the Black Panther Party, Republic of New Africa, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, the Congress of African People, and the Shrine of the Black Madonna. Before you kind of capsulize the what you would consider the Cultural Revolution during that period, I want to ask you a question in relation to that, because you see how, and you state how different offshoots or different critical analysis brought action with these other groups coming out of Malcolm's understanding. Would I be wrong to say that the Garvey movement stemmed the growth of the Nation of Islam and Black Hebrew Israelites and things like that during at the end of Garveyism or after Garvey was jailed? You've seen movements starting around the 1920s. Would I be wrong in stating some of those understandings that came out of that Garvey movement started those movements?
No, brother, and I wouldn't say the interpretation is not wrong.
Okay.
I think it's, but I would argue that it's insufficiently broad.
Okay.
Now, remember, Callie House is leading the Ex-Slave Bounty and Pension Association. She's fighting for black reparations in the 1890s. She's
yes.
going to be put in prison in the around the turn of the century.
Okay.
So it's important that what Garvey is doing is taking advantage of what's already there. And what is it that allows him to take advantage? First, his black nationalist message, but also because blacks are now are heavily urbanized.
Okay.
There's a reason why Garvey does what he does and reaches such magnitude in Harlem that he doesn't reach in Kingston. You see, because the Great Migration is one of the things that Garvey took advantage of, and I mean that in the most positive sense,
mm-hmm.
because the Harlem Renaissance was preceded by renaissances in Washington, D.C., especially. But as long as it's not a singular focus, but it'd be ahistorical not to argue that Garvey gives rise to both the Moorish Science Temple,
okay.
the Nation of Islam, so many different black nationalist organizations, including Malcolm's mother and father. His mother's from Grenada, but his mother and father in the UNIA,
mm-hmm.
including all the way up to the Division Number 407 in Detroit, where he was even after his father's passed. But I would make the point that what Malcolm does is very different than what Garvey's. And see, and this is the key about the transformation of black nationalism. And this is often misunderstood. Only black folks in this country had to fight for even having a culture. That's why Stuckey and Stuckey's book is so important. So it's Du Bois in the Souls of Black Folks in 1903. That he's arguing that not only that African Americans have a culture, Africans themselves have a great culture and the first cultures in the world. This is 1903. He's not the first to say that. He doesn't argue that either. But what I'm saying is this is when popular conceptions of that suggested black folks didn't have a culture were challenged in 1903. And I would argue they're not overthrown yet, but these debates are being had in black communities too. So it's Du Bois who does that. Garvey, as Moses says, still has one foot in the 19th century, one foot in the 20th century. He accepts some of that, but in another sense, he is arguing about going, brothers and sisters here, going back to Africa and civilizing the Africans. He used that language
right.
too. See, Malcolm's not talking that. So it's important to see the distinctions. Of course, and Garvey isn't arguing that we are Moors, but he wouldn't argue that. He would only argue that that's not the totality of who we are, and we're definitely not Asiatic. This is a misunderstanding from Farrar. And I want to be clear that no. Let me just stop there, mm-hmm. so I can answer your question succinctly.
You know, I appreciate where how this discussion is folding, and it's taking me in two different directions that we here at Time for Awakening are having between me and Elliot, and then with the Time for Awakening audience, because in what Stuckley was saying and what I hear you saying, it is a nationalist formation, and wrong. When we say a nationalist formation, a kind of social relationship that is looking at has all of the makings of we can be self-autonomous and operate in the land space that we are in, absent of being inclusive in the European or the American, you know, white supremacist dominated society. Is that a thought that makes sense?
That's an excellent point, brother. I have a whole chapter, and I want to preach it. It's a 500-page book, so I want to do justice to these things I'm writing about. And it's so in the chapter where I talk more about black nationalism, and black nationalism is just as you're intimating here. It's just a view, like all nationalism, that the political and the social be congruent. That a society, a culture has the right and responsibility to articulate its own political formation that would guide it or that it would be structured under. It was a part of what we call self-determination. But now that could be an independent state, but it doesn't have to be. It could be an autonomous political unity in a federation, for example. See, and this is these are aspects of what Paul Cuffey argued in the 18th century. And this is where Black Nationalism comes from. It starts in the 18th century. And Moses' research is excellent at that. Black Nationalism is not derivative of any other kind of nationalism. It's not derived from American white nationalism, French nationalism, or Zionism, none of them. That's what Moses shows us. But it goes back to the 18th century, not the 19th, where Cussy is arguing for he wants support to return to Africa, support to have an independent territory in the United States, or an autonomous formation within those 13 colonies. So what you're saying is that's historical. That's it. And but often folks who are talking about black, they miss that. Right. And here, when I say folks, I mean scholars in general.
And it creates, I want to just throw out another one and apologize, you know, but just to be clear, because this, again, we have this discussion because there is some tension within our, with those of us here, whether it be about self-identification and who we identify with, because Fort Mosey, which those who, I think that was in the around 1730s or whatever, who were leaving enslaved Africans who were recently brought over, goes to Florida and under an African leader, presents a social order that even they had to, I think it was Jackson, had to really fight against later on. And then the other one, I think, Elliot, you bring up, have brought up a couple of times, the discussion with the reverends after the Civil War of what is it that you want? I think, I forget the general that brought those religious leaders together, mm-hmm. and they decided that it would be best for us to work amongst ourselves and build, and we see the product, the end product of that. So what I hear you saying is that this thinking of being self-autonomous isn't something that just comes out even in the 20th century. This has a historical continuity to it.
Sure. What you're referring to in the 18th century, this was several Baptist ministers. This is the Lincoln administration under right. Stanton. It's often associated with Sherman's March to the Sea. But Sherman wasn't allowed in the meeting. This was Stanton. He was meeting with the leader of there they elected was George Fraser, who was a reverend there. And he asked him what he wanted. He wanted land. You know what I'm saying? and then what you said going back is interesting, and I support this looking at 1619, that's important, but it's important to look at 1526 and the Petit River complex, and also even later than that, but before 1619, the Roanoke, the lost colonies.
Right,
the reason
right.
why 1526 is not remembered because they weren't English, and the enslaved Africans overthrew them and killed their slave masters, and the lost colony. Well, how do you think it became lost? So 1619 is the first successful English settlement, but it's not the first one. And African autonomy. There's excellent research by John Thornton to show that some of these the movements and the resistance, like the Stono Rebellion, what they did, they used military techniques from the from what would be present day from Congo with the K, present day Angola. You see, and we can demonstrate that because we know we have we can document the military science of those communities, and we even have starting in 1506, we call him Marimba, the Europeans call him Dom Afonso, is in correspondence. It's 1506. He's in correspondence with King Manuel of Portugal. So he's writing in Portuguese and he's writing in Congolese. We have documentation of the correspondence back and forth. So when I say we can demonstrate this, I mean, we can demonstrate this empirically. These things are not widely debated among folks who study these things. I should qualify those who study them seriously.
Dr. Henderson, the era that you're talking about is very interesting in our experience here in this country that your book focuses in on, the 60s and 70s, during what is considered the Black Power era. And we have these discussions a lot with myself, Richard, off the air, on the air, and with some of the listening audience. And it's a question that I ponder a lot, but dealing with the reality of the situation, if the period of our enslavement left real damage mentally to our people, and we see Some of the things that you point out in your book, some of the movements that you point out, is a resurrection of the minds of our people to realize their independence, to realize their need for independence, and knowing that they're a great people, and we should get back to standing on our feet as a people. But I think that our people, when we talk about these things, and I'm not necessarily talking about you, I'm just talking about people in general, they underestimate, downplay, or maybe don't even realize the government intervention to stop these movements and the tactics used to do it. Talk about that period that you're talking about and some of the groups that you mentioned here, Black Panther Party, the Republic of New Africa, Revolutionary Black Workers, all of these groups, and including Malcolm, were jailed, political prisoners, some of them silenced with death. Talk about the importance that our people need to really take critical look at and really have critical discussion on, is the government intervention to smashing these movements and how it was utilized against our people to the point where other people that look like us was very damaging in these movements.
Well, if I may take some liberty with the question, because one thing that I challenge, I share with folks, I said, like, I'm not a big advocate of unity, you know, unity for unity's sake.
Okay.
I say, show me anywhere in the world with 40 million people spread around a million square miles or unified about anything. Black Americans, we are here. We're the only people threatened with death to learn to read and write. So this not even dealing with the crimes against humanity, which was enslavement and colonialism, and crimes against humanity is a phrase that a black man came up with, George Washington Williams, a Civil War vet, when he observes the atrocities in King Leopold's Congo. We are the folks still, it's just like Karinga's right about that. He said, we're the moral vanguard of this country. We define what's freedom, justice, and equality, not only for this country, but for much of the world. That is, when people want to legitimate their liberation struggles, they raise our images, they sing our songs, etc. Black culture is rooted in three things. Fundamentally, it extends beyond this, but fundamentally, freedom. You can't talk about freedom seriously in this country. We're talking about the freedom struggle of black people. The second was education. As I said, we're the only people threatened with death to learn how to read. Now, we have HBCUs, we have college, we have educated people. I'm not saying, but we often get trained just to look at what's negative about this instead of saying, this is astonishing. How did we do this? And the third one is family. One of the biggest movements of black people before the Great Migration was after our manumission, after the end of chattel slavery. Black men and women moved throughout the South. You know what they were moving throughout the South to do, brethren?
Find their family.
Find their family.
Finding their family. Family can't be defined in this country without that. So I want to start with that, because often, not you, brother, but often when people are talking, as soon as you get to talk about what we as black people come, you know it's going to be something negative. What we don't do. I'm talking about, how did we get here? And again, if it's not from the good graces of white people, and it wasn't, how did we do that?
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible. We define democracy in this country. How did we do that? See? So, with that as a context, Malcolm wants liberation. He wants liberation. He says that we have to propose, it's from Malcolm, he says we have to launch a cultural revolution to unbrainwash a whole generation of people.
Okay.
Malcolm wants a political and a cultural revolution. Malcolm's going to be killed before he's 40 years old, so he won't fully develop his thesis. He believes that this political revolution will be part of a worldwide revolution, which he sees as comprised by these anti-colonial revolutions going on all over the world, 90 miles off the U.S. coast in Cuba, but also in Vietnam, throughout Africa, but epitomized in Vietnam with respect to the perspective of his U.S. audience, I should say. But also, you see it in struggles related to anti-colonial movements in Africa and Asia more broadly. But I'm just thinking about time, so I don't want to go. But he also sees the need for a cultural revolution. And remember the point I made before, that black folks, we are the people who are denied a culture. So if you don't have a sense of your culture, you have very little sense of what type of, or even have a basis for your nationalism, you see? So Malcolm wants a cultural revolution as well. And this is why Malcolm forms the OAU, but also he keeps Muslim Mosque Incorporated. Malcolm appreciates that there's a religious aspect to this. It's like when I hear people talking today, they say, man, one problem, you can't organize black people. You know, they're so apathetic. And it's ridiculous. But they'll say, you know, the only, you can find two things you can find on the corner in the black community, you know, a dope house and a church. I say, well, that's a hit and a half. You should know how to organize black people then. Because that's where you should be, right? How you going to organize black people? You won't go in the church. Talking trash, but even Huey came to that. He said, when the Black Panther Party distanced ourselves from the church, we were distancing ourselves from black community. But you got to go up in there and use the vehicles you have at your disposal. But back to Malcolm. So Malcolm doesn't develop the culture, the thesis on the cultural revolution. And this is one of the shortcomings, a huge shortcoming of Marable's book, because Malcolm thought this was essential to revolution in the United States, and he proposed the beginnings of it. He said, I won't go into what he said, but he proposed the beginnings of it, but he was killed. He was assassinated by five members of the NOI in conjunction with those same agencies you were just talking about of the U.S. federal government and local and police agencies to assassinate Minister Malcolm before he turned 40, just as King will be assassinated right before he turns 40, right? So, but the problem, a problem was, and I want to make a point, I'm not mad at none of these folks. I'm trying to build on their work. So if they were back here today, I could give it to them. This is what I came up with. And this is the people who taught me.
Okay.
The people who were in the Panther Party, people who were in the Republic of New Africa, people in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, the people like the person I'm about to say now. So when Muhammad Ahmed helped organize RAM, they, along with Wanda Marshall and so many others now, but I say brother because he's right there in Philly,
right,
and he still is right there in Philly.
Yes.
And he gave me the mistakes in the book are all mine. He gave me suggestions about this, and it helped me when I was going in different directions. But he's a wonderful brother and a wonderful teacher. But when he's organizing with Queen Mother Moore and all those folks, I encourage him. He takes aspects, they and Ram take aspects of Malcolm's thesis. And one of the shortcomings of it is many of them, not just Ram, Ram's just simply the first. They're the first major black organization, revolutionist organization to build directly off Malcolm's thesis. It'll be the thesis of cultural revolution, that is. Ram will do it, then us, and then the others you mentioned. So, But one of the problems was they treated Malcolm's thesis as completed. They didn't finish it. For example, brother, have you heard people say Malcolm's taken out because he's going to take the U.S. to the United Nations? I mean, this is just silly. Do you know the U.S. was controlling the United Nations, right? Just like they do
right.
Now.
And still
okay.
Do.
Okay. Also, Malcolm's not the first. The NAACP and Du Bois had gave an appeal to the world in 1947 to the United Nations. We, Brother Patterson, William and Louise Patterson had put, we charged genocide in 1951.
Right.
Queen Mother Moore had already, this wasn't a new, it's just something how folks get caught up in this lingo, or they get caught up in these simplistic rationalizations. You think that Malcolm and others didn't know that the United Nations, the United States controlled the United Nations? That wasn't, what was key to Malcolm was to help organize, and if you read, I'm not saying if you read, as you read Malcolm's diary, you see that Malcolm is trying to organize what he thinks is going to be this third way. He mistakenly sees it at Bandung. Bandung was not a meeting of all the non-white people. White people were there, okay? Malcolm's not it's so important to demystify exactly what he's doing. But back to Ram. Ram takes what he's doing as completed. I'm not mad at them. They're young folks. They're involved in revolutionary struggle. Just like I'm not mad at members of the Black Panther Party, people who taught me, us organizers. I'm not mad. I'm trying to build on their work. And to build on, have to make a critical assessment. This was Malcolm's fundamental flaw in his theory, where 19th and early 20th century black nationalists argued that Africans were behind African Americans. So they would say things like, Black Americans need to go civilize them. Sounded just like the white supremacists. No, not the white supremacists. Sounded just like, see, I don't want to use the word C-R-A-C-K-A. You know, working at a public university, they may jam me up all types of things. But that's what I would say. They would sound just like some of these white folks. They argued that we must develop Africa, see, economically and militarily. But they also used the language of a civilized mission. Why? Because they were not convinced about the culture of Africans either, okay?
Right.
We call that civilizationism. That's what Moses calls them. So he said that so these folks from Henry McNeil Turner, you know, bless his heart. I mean, incredible organizer, and also sometimes Garvey, they would fall into this view of Africans in this benighted way as need to be civilized, okay? So that they were behind the African Americans. Malcolm reversed that. He said, no, these Africans, because he's faced with the independence movement, 16 African countries become independent in 1960 alone. So you have Malcolm saying they're getting their freedom. They're getting their own governments, their own self-rule, because they're embedded in their culture. We're the ones who don't know our culture. So Malcolm's convinced that black folks were stripped of their culture. See? So he says we have, and we need that as part of our revolutionary struggle, so we have to do what the Africans are doing. See, he said, when he says you left your mind in Africa, some folks took that too literally. Malcolm suffered from what we call reverse civilizationism. See, because as what was going on in Africa, U.S. was in Africa. And what he was proposing is a transformation in the most powerful country in the world for people who were still confused about their culture. The Africans knew if you may want to, there's a struggle in creating a Ghana, but there's no struggle in understanding Asante culture. Eve, tree, they exist. You see what I'm saying? All you have to do is throw off the colonial raiment and go back to articulating your culture in Kenya. You get the English out, then you can talk Kikuyu, you talk Luo, right? You can talk Swahili, you can talk, because there are cultures there. In the United States, it's not the same. Black folks were still debating, what were they? What were we? So a cultural revolution was necessary in the United States. But Malcolm thought it would follow forth. Remember, he doesn't complete it. It would follow what was happening in the anti-colonial struggles abroad. That was a huge mistake. Reverse civilizations, that we had to be more African. And instead of, and also because they knew their culture, they were involved in revolution, those were the revolutions we had to study. So he misses the slave revolution, the revolution right under his feet. And that's what the followers would miss as well. Ram would pick it up later. Us organization didn't study culture this way, unfortunately. I talk about this in the book. And the Panthers are valorizing lumpen culture, lumpen proletarian culture, for similar reasons, but not exactly for reverse civilizationist reasons. It's really the League of Revolutionary Black Workers that get that the culture of black folks is like Malcolm. Look at who Malcolm was. Malcolm was grounded with the masses, but he was a religious guy. You see what I'm saying? This is what we find. Isn't this what we find in our community? People who will outwardly espouse something, some kind of religion, often Christianity, but our culture has a religious aspect to it, but it's not deeply religious. I want to make that clear. Not more than any other group, but it is a religious aspect to it, and it's very urban, and it's modern. Our culture is an African-American culture. It's not an African one. And I mean overwhelmingly. I'm not saying, and there's great diversity. Remember the point I made about not being for unity? I'm only being slightly facetious. I mean, there's diversity in all this. There's 40 million of us. There's great diversity among us. And that's why I don't get upset if somebody has a different point of view. There's no monolithic approach to this. You know what I'm saying? So many of the other organizations were trying to do this. Then they wanted to have a cultural revolution without engaging the church, the exception being Jeremoji in the Shrine of Black Madonna. How are you going to have a cultural institution without engaging the most dominant cultural institution? I'm sorry. How are you going to have a cultural revolution if you don't engage the most dominant cultural institution in your society? I mean, in black society. Larry Neal peeped this. He said, we as black guys, we got to stop saying this. We got to stop distancing ourselves from the church and come up in there and transform that. See? And then the second thing was they wanted to have a cultural revolution, but they wouldn't meaningfully engage. Only too late that they meaningfully engage the major cultural contradiction within our society, which is sexism. See? So so these were important. It was the League of Revolutionary Black Workers that came closest to doing this. So when they abandoned the church was strengthened because of the civil rights movement in King, including having great political efficacy. Remember, when Garvey is contending, he really doesn't have rivals in the black church. That's why he could build his own church.
Okay.
He didn't have rivals like that. You have exceptions like Powell and some of these others at Abyssinian, but for the most part, the church wasn't activist. Ida B. Wells often complained about the church wouldn't even support the anti-lynching initiative she had taken. But not in the 1960s. And after the Voting Rights Act of 65, the church, members of the church saw that they could be politically efficacious. They could act politically and still be in the church. See? So who came to them? The nationalists often moved away from them. And who came? The people who would become our black elected officials. And this is epitomizing what happens with Baraka and Cap in Newark. Because remember, Baraka, what does he do? These are black masses. They organized the ascension of the first black mayor of a major eastern seaboard city. And it just 3 years late, 2 years later, he could turn his back on them. Because the black church then, as the nationalists moved, the Democratic Party came in. And when the Democratic Party came in, that was the co-option that went on. See, brother, what I would say, I talk about the atrocities, the political prisoners. I list the political prisoners in my book and show how many of the black political prisoners who are still in captivity, like Rochelle McGee, been half a century, while you have white members of SDS, white folks who've been involved in all types of expropriations, all type of what's considered crimes or political crimes, who are university professors now. While we still have from Russell Schultz to Jaleel Mutakine to, of course, Mumia to all these political prisoners, Sister Nahanda, who just passed, and, of course, Asada, who's in exile, where you have Bernadine Dorn as a professor, you see? So I talk about those things. But I'm saying, how did we strategize to talk and make meaningful physically and materially our liberation? And this is what I want to show in the book, and then to see where we missed and then apply it to today. I want to stop because I know I've been going a while.
You know, one thing, there's two things, and one I'm like really hesitant because I don't know if it fits in the conversation. But as you mentioned this earlier about theory, and what came in my mind as you were developing that period and Malcolm was Bobby Wright, his whole question about social theory, needing to develop a social theory. Yes. Am I off to thinking that what you're really describing, especially for us when you talk about strategizing, is one thing to be doing things in the moment of time. It's another thing to be doing things out of a theoretical framework. Is that an appropriate way to be able to frame how we should even look at while we're going through your work as far as this particular book and trying to understand how we should be developing ourselves and our outlook looking towards the future?
As long as we say one way that may have been proven successfully in the past, so we keep open. Malcolm is the open texture to knowledge, Malcolm used to point out. So I rarely would say we only or have to, or something. Not suggesting that you're right. Doing that, but for people who may be listening. But this how I think about a theory sometime, brother. Brother, you know basketball, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you familiar with
now,
that?
Now, okay. Elliot's more a basketball person. I learned from him.
but you've observed, because I think of you and culture, and this aspect of popular culture, basketball.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It used to bother me, brother, when I would see people like Magic, and people would talk about his God-given talent. Of all the things God got to do, I don't think teaching you how to have an incredible handle on the basketball is one of them. I was like, didn't Magic practice? I mean, didn't he develop some of these skills? When you see black athletes and they'll say, he's just naturally, he did that instinctively. There's nothing instinctive about a game. He learned and he practices, see? Theory, you think of it as the strategies that you emerges, it can come from repetition. But it's important to know that as people are repeating it, they're learning. I think it was a white sports commentator. He would probably be the only one at the time that could get his this on the cover of Sports Illustrated at the time. And he says, Magic Johnson epitomizes the thinking ball player. And this was controversial at the time when he wrote it. Because, you know, we didn't think. We just do stuff instinctively, especially about basketball and stuff like that. That's why I asked. See? Theory is a framework. Theory, there are different type of theory, empirical and normative, but the type of theory I'm talking about is social theory, and theory is nothing more than a coherent set of law-like generalizations that have descriptive, explanatory, and predictive capacity, many of those empirical observations already being substantiated. That's an empirical theory. Normative theory guides you to what ought to be. Empirical theory guides you to what is. So in my international relations courses, I say the leading states in the world organize through balance of power theory. So when I say theory, I'm not talking about a hunch or speculation. In this sense, Bobby Wright is on point. And what Bobby Wright said in the psychopathic racial personality, He said, that would be a hypothesis. In the collective, where the variable is race, whites behave as psychopaths. That was Bobby Wright's thesis. Right. So, but his notion of theory, yeah, he got it. This is a part of social theory, but it's more inclined with Harold Cruz. It's Harold Cruz is the crisis of Negro intellectual. He said black folks must devise the theory to guide their revolution. And he said over 50 years ago that the key to this was cultural revolution because of the intervention of media in our ability to mobilize. Now, he said that before rap music. He said that before social media. Yet, on the 50th anniversary of the publication of his book, University of Michigan didn't have a program celebrating the 50th anniversary. I was waiting to submit my paper for whoever put it together. Then I saw nobody's putting it together. So me and brother James Taylor did most of this work at the University of San Francisco, put on a program in honor of Harold Cruz's work, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. Now, Harold Cruz was one of my professors at Michigan.
Okay.
But my teachers have been those. I have an older sister who's in the Panther Party. I was born in 62, so I didn't participate in any of this. But these folks taught me. I sat at the feet of Imari Obadeli and Queen Mother Moore, and I listened last month, to Muhammad Ahmed, Akua and Jerry, Fred Hampton's common law wife, Hakeem Madhubuti. These folks that the stories I'm telling from fiction, many of the members of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, General Baker, Marion Kramer, so many of these folks, to build on, because what they were sharing with me was the strategy. It's our strategy, because I could see already that we weren't good at counterintelligence. And this gets back to what we were talking about before, how they could be undermined by these agencies. But we have to get past this, how you say, there's so much hyperbole associated with this. Like there's no time in that the United States saw the Black Panther Party as the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. Hoover didn't believe that. He says that for propaganda reasons, so he can then kill a bunch of them.
Mm-hmm.
He was more concerned with the white folks and the anti-Vietnam War movement. That's what was threatening them, and especially the national security, and that's what's going to become to fruition with the defeat of the United States in the Vietnam War. I care about the Black Panther Party. So I would argue with sometimes, but I would sit and listen to Geronimo Pratt. You see? So I would take these lessons. Again, I say I'm not mad at them. I'm trying to build on their work. And especially the theory. And they would constantly tell me we didn't have time to. So I showed. And I would take the theory from their actions, but some of them, even in their writings, I saw. Because now my white colleagues would say, well, Errol, come on, you're putting theory where it didn't exist. No, I'm that's why I have so many quotes in the book to show, no, they were theorizing. See? They were theorizing, but they just didn't have the time. See? So again, I said, I'm not mad. That's why it's 500 pages. It's a serious book. I'm so tired of these folks with their little novellas. 100, 200 pages on something as monumental as Black liberation. How in the hell you do that?
Well, I have to say, brother, that it was interesting because when we knew we were reaching out to get you, so we were going to go and get the book now. I want to alert people because unless we, I would like you to mention a direct publisher that you feel comfortable to get the book because it seems that we have a challenge. I went to Barnes & Noble as an example. No, they only came up with the hard copy and said $99.
Yes.
When there's a $23 paper book copy.
That's right. Now, who I'm talking to is this brother Booker or brother
Richard? That's Richard. That's Richard.
Now, brother Richard, do you think, listen to this, brother Richard, just me and you, as far as way back as we go, me and you, brother Richard, do you think I already know something like that? Walk with me for a minute, Brother Richard. You're going to like where I end up. Now, Brother Richard, do you think most professors who publish know that?
I take it.
Yes. So, Brother Richard, what I had before the book was published, a guarantee from the publisher that it could be available online for free. All you got to do is download it. You'll see in the bio I sent you all, there's a link to it. Anybody can, from the church, from the Wi-Fi at a coffee shop, wherever you can. You can download the book for free. And that's what I organized. It's called the Tome Initiative, T-O-M-E. So you can read it online for free. It was free before it was published. My next book on religion and world politics, that was going to be free too. Now you can pay for the hardback. It's usually 90s. They got the $9 markup, I take it. And then the paperback is $24.95, but you can get the whole book. It's free. It's online. I hope we can give that to folks when they get, because that's the thing about, I grew up in the Brewster Projects in the east side of Detroit. So if you got a class analysis that then, when it gets to this, you're like, yeah, Brother Rich, yeah, it's $99, man. You know, I can't do nothing about that. You're going to pose revolutionary struggle and you don't know how to make your book free? Huh? You know what I'm saying? So this is part of our challenge. These things can be free. If we find what we did, make a way out of no way. How I look coming to y'all talking about, yeah, brother, yeah, we can have a book sign, you know, mine $99, you know. I got a problem with that. Now watch this, brother. I ain't knocking nobody who do it. That's I'm talking about the argument that I'm making. Mm-hmm. And I'm not knocking nobody for, you know, but I'm saying I am knocking them if they're saying they're ignorant and because they haven't went out and searched for another way to do this. Right. And there are many, many publishers that will publish and will, with this agreement, there's got to be, it's almost 100 of them. Academic presses, this is not difficult to do. It bothers me immensely when I hear professors talk about how difficult it is what we do. Man, this job is different, but it ain't difficult. Difficult, I'm from Detroit, it's working in that plant, working in the phosphate mines, that's difficult. This ain't difficult, it's different. But folks will come on here and they'll just say things and just to puff themselves up. And it's not personal. What I'm saying is we should be demystifying these things for our people. Okay. We should be demystifying them. See? So I'm the example from the Brewster Project. That's where I was born and raised, on the east side of Detroit. See? I'm an example of that. That's what I represent. See, and I never I constantly remind folks of that when they talk about the potential of black people or when they talk about what we don't do. How do I do that from the Bruce, and I'm not the smartest one in the Bruce. I wasn't the smartest one in my block. I wasn't the smartest one in my house. But what do we have? We have opportunities to do certain things. And when we organizing, when we're organizing the gangs for peace, when we organizing with the mothers of murdered children in Detroit, to organize with the people right there. Because the transformation, this cultural revolution comes from a transformation of the culture itself. And the key to that is already in the culture. You don't need to learn another language. See? Now, if you learn, I'm all for learning different languages. Don't get me wrong, brother. But I'm saying you don't have to. You just start practicing what it is that you observe daily. Because what you observe daily, the best of what you observe is probably your culture. But it's important to demystify that. Like I said, when we organize the gays, brother say, oh, Brother Earl, you know, I've been down here, man. You know, I see death every day. I'm like, no, you don't. No, no, no. I said, my brother's in Vietnam. He didn't see death every day. I live in the project. The first dead body I saw, I was 9 years old. I didn't see death every day. Didn't you see expressions of love and caring and devotion and dedication as well? So why can't we build on that? You see what I'm saying? So don't accept these little axiomatic things, you know, we just always again. Who trained you to think that way? That's what I mean when I say white supremacy don't just teach you what to think, it teach you how to think. How many people you heard use false dichotomies and they think they're actually having a substantive argument? One would go like this. Well, I hear what you say, but, you know, I'm not perfect. But I said, you said I'm not perfect. Wait a minute. Was there any debate that maybe you were perfect? Why would you say that? As if you're making an argument here. We talk about the perpetuation of white supremacism. One of the things that facilitates it is this notion that there are two sides to every story. No, some stories have 3, 4, 5,000 sides, and some of them only got one meaningful one. That is, the person motivated to initiate, participate in a crime against humanity, there's no other side to that. That is a reasonable reason to do it. No, I don't accept that. And it's important. We demystify these things. Don't give them new names. We built right here. We transformed. The lessons are right beneath our feet, but they're often difficult to see. And that's one reason why the revolution would not be theorized. It can be theorized now because I built on the theory. It's not my thing. I combined Du Bois, Alain Locke, Harold Cruz, Sister Claudia Jones, Harry Haywood, some of their theories, not the people. So sometimes you'll hear, brother, they come back, yeah, you know what you say about Du Bois. Okay, I'm listening to you, Brother Earl, you know all that. But, you know, Du Bois also during World War One, he tried to get a commission in the Army to be a captain. You know, he tried to do that. So how would you go? I said, I ain't trying to take him home with me. I'm just talking about this theoretical argument. I ain't trying to marry the man. What are you talking about? Meanwhile, the white folks proposing theory, quoting people, Marxist folks like Althusser. Althusser's a prominent Marxist theory. He killed his wife. They still quote Althusser. They tell him, you and me, well, you got to choose Du Bois or Booker T. Washington. You only get one. Why these people talk about their founding father? They take them all. We're supposed to get one. Malcolm or Martin, you only get one. No, reject that. I'm taking them all with respect to that theory, because we only hear because of our people, the strategizing of our people. We're not super athletes. We're not super religious. We're not super none of this. We are excellent strategists.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can get involved in this conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in conversation with Professor Earl A. Henderson. The book, The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized, Cultural Revolution in the Black Power Era. And plus, we're going to transition and talk about a few other things dealing with his work right after the break. Again, you can get involved by dialing 215-490-9832. When we come back, Professor Henderson, I want to, because I wanted to bring up some of the things that was written in the paper, Hidden in Plain Sight. But before we do that, I want to ask you some questions about your organizing when you were a college student. But we'll do that after the break. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple. It really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
not encouraged. Let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:22 here in the city of Philadelphia. We're in conversation tonight with Professor Earl A. Henderson. The book, The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized, Cultural Revolution in the Black Power Era. We're going to be discussing some of Professor Henderson's other work and his upcoming publication that's due out this February. You can get involved in the conversation also by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Professor Henderson.
Yes, sir.
Before we went to break, you were mentioning about yourself, and you weren't the smartest in your own household. And I usually ask folks this that have been on our program, whether it's activists, authors, historians, things of that nature, about them. And I'm associated with something you wrote here in the bio I read about your activism in 1987 in response to racial threats against black women on the campus of University of Michigan, and also being involved and helped lead an extended protest that included an 11-day building occupation at Wayne State University in 1989 that led to the creation of the long sought after Department of African Studies. Talk about yourself, your upbringing. You mentioned about you sitting at the feet of certain people. Just talk about you. Did you come from a household where your mother and father's kind of stress cultural values, gave you a strong background in yourself and your history. Just talk a little bit about yourself before we kind of transition over to Hidden in Plain Sight.
Okay. Let me see. I was born and raised in Brewster Projects. That's mm-hmm. where I was born. I wasn't born in a hospital. I was born in the projects. And my mother's from the South. My father's from Jamaica. I'm the youngest of my mother's 9. My father's 13. And I was just real sickly as a child. So I used to, my mother would read. We had a lot of books there. Because I'm the youngest, the books were from, everybody's older than me.
Okay.
And we were very poor, so often we didn't have television. And if we had television, father, when he got upset, he'd take the plug from it, so we couldn't watch it for days or weeks. But my mother instilled, she's from Alabama, so she talked to me about the South a lot. And my father, he was really abusive, bitter man.
Okay.
He's very angry. And but he would talk to us as well. And I had one brother went off to Vietnam. His sister, the oldest sister, was in the Detroit chapter of the Black Panther Party. Others of us did a variety of things. But I got into reading mainly because I was sickly and I'd be at home a lot. So I had to read the books that was left, and I would read the books from my age, and then I would just keep going. So, and then we would go to the library. My parents would, on the weekends, we went to the library. We would trek to the library, you know. So I wasn't unintelligent. I was often uninterested, especially once I could do the work, you know. I don't know how much of this I want to say. Let me see. So, if I jump ahead, by the time I get into the public school, but the public school you had called Cass Tech, you had to be accepted into it. And once I got in there and got on the honor roll, I'm like, I got nothing else to prove, you know. So then I was just a nut after that. We used to swim. Swimming was big as a sport in the projects because where we were, see, in Brewster Center, Wheeler Center, that's where Joe Louis trained, see?
Okay. Right.
Matter of fact, when Ali comes back to fight that last fight, he trains in Brewster Center out of respect for that. And the projects have been destroyed now, but the center is still there because they know they can't get rid of that. But so swimming was big. Because I was sickly, my mother liked that. Then I got tall. I was a real little guy. I'm just about 6'1". Anyway, but what happened then in the projects when the drugs came? First it was mixed jive and then crack. So when I was 17, I went to the army. I went to the army from 17 to 19. Because I was a nut, and I had to go to night school to graduate from high school, even though I was in that what you call it high school. That it was a public school, but you had to be accepted into it. And me and my boy, who was all world in basketball, we both had coaches to speak up for. And when they came to kick us out to school, we told them we wouldn't leave. And they just never had nobody to do that. So we wouldn't leave. So and we had to go to night school to graduate. So I wasn't going to sell dope. And so I went to the army. But like I said, my brother's in Vietnam. So he taught me things like how you make sure you, among other things, he taught me things. So I never fired a shot in anger. I did what I had to do in Detroit. I was never like a badass, nothing like that. I was the skinny, smart guy, you know?
Okay.
And but then when I got in the Army and I came back, I filled out, you know? And I started college the same semester my mother died. And I just did excellent in college just on anger alone. I was walking from the projects going to the school, and the police would, mess with you and this kind of thing. And where I was in the projects, there was like a subculture of resistance there. My first memories of life is the 67 revolt, you know, because that's when I saw tanks and that's when I saw armored personnel carriers. But I also saw the brothers, I won't say their name, who would get on the roof and they were engaging the police, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't understand this then, you know. But I always had older people telling me and teaching. It wasn't sticking. It wasn't until I got to college, and that's when I saw. And when I saw, I had people like Shokwe Lumumba was there, Imari, and a lot of the folks from the the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, these folks, they just come together and they start telling us about our obligations. And that's when the stuff I learned as a child really kicked in.
Okay.
But about liberation, said if you're going to be a student, you got to be a student of the liberation of your people. So it just kicked in then in 83. So by that's when we started organizing, you know. I was from the projects. A lot of my friends had been, they were in jail or they were dead or they were in the dope game. And wasn't going to do that. And so then I just the organizing started. And that's pretty much, that's sort of the background up until those two events you're talking about.
Okay. And, you know, we talk a lot about that organizing being a skill. But we'll touch on that. Let me go to this call. We got 647. 647?
Norman?
Yes, sir. You're there.
How are both of you? How's everyone doing?
I'm doing great. We got a little echo. Are you on a hands-free or you on a speaker?
I'm on. Yeah. Can you hear me better?
Yeah. Go ahead. We got you.
Okay. I wanted to let brother, is Arrow?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was in the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and I knew General Gordon Baker Jr. and Marion Kramer. Well, Marion Kramer is still in the land of the living, but I remember Dennis Edwards supported Michael Hamlin, and when Michael Hamlin, the general, let me put it this way, Dennis Edwards had a very good social consciousness because he supported a Kenny Cockrell. Kenny Cockrell, the great lawyer, who was like some people say he was even greater than Johnny Cochran when it came to a lawyer.
Yes, sir.
Because he was, you know Kenny Cockrell. You can explain. Kenny Cockrell was tough, and his son, I think, became the mayor. But I was just wanted to say that I was in the house when Robert F. Williams came back from China. He came to General Baker's house, and I was blessed to have sat at his feet, you know, and just listened to him talk about, the People's Republic of China, so on and so forth. But I just basically wanted to thank you for this interview. Some great information. And I'll be purchasing your books.
Or you can get it free online, there, brother. Dear brother, would you mind sharing your name?
Norman Otis Richmond.
Norman Richmond, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Please go.
Waistline, Waistline and
yes, Darryl Waistline Mitchell.
Darryl Waistline Mitchell, yes, Chuck Wooten,
yes, sir.
Cassandra Smith. Yeah, all of those. That's my second home.
Yes, sir. It's a blessing talking with you, Brother Richmond.
All right, thank you.
Yes, sir. I'd like to comment on that. The brother is right. The League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and again, I have a large section on them, and I was and I've known General Baker since the. But again, when I come of consciousness, I mean, it's in the early '80s, and this is so important that the revolutionary things that General Baker, Marion Kramer, and so many of the folks that the brother mentioned, Chuck Wooten, Waistline Mitchell. These Edna Watson, Diane Bernard, Maureen, Sister Maureen as well. What they were doing in the '60s was profound. It's profound, and I talk about that in the book. But I meet them in the '80s, and they're still organizing. Mary Kramer is still organizing now for water rights in Detroit. This is Sister Marion.
Now wait, when you said Maureen,
one of the things I like
when you said Maureen, you talking about Maureen Taylor?
Yeah, Maureen Taylor. Thank you so much, brother.
She was on our program, too.
No, boy. I forgot her last name.
Yeah,
Maureen.
Yeah, she was on our program.
Oh, that's a blessing. Yes, sir. And so these folks would advise us, and we were younger folks, but we were organizing. And one of the reasons we could do what we did is because they were there with us.
Okay.
Or they was there making the connections with us. And then Keiko Tseeli, Gloria House, Shokwe Lumumba, especially Brother Kwame Kenyatta, who just passed, in the building with us during the takeover at Wayne State in 89. But we first did in 87. There's a frontline special on it called Racism 101. It's not good, but at least you can see the impact we were having in 87 at the University of Michigan. But then what we did in 89, we learned the lessons. And I commuted to Ann Arbor. It's 47 miles from Detroit. So I commuted to Ann Arbor even when I was a student in Michigan. I always lived in Detroit. And so I brought students up there from Wayne State in 87, and then they did in 89, then we did it in 89. But it's because of folks like this. We organized. General Baker was still organizing. General Baker and Marion Kramer, we're organizing, think about this, with the homeless, organizing tent cities in the 80s. And then I never forget this with General. That General just an incredible brother, incredible brother. Think about this. He's all, and I said this to Brother General. We are out in a lot. We're making a memorial for this 16-year-old named Gary Glenn, who's shot in his back by the police as he's running to his mother's porch. He had just escaped from the youth home, but he wasn't in the youth home for like no serious offense. You know, it's like truancy kind of thing. He run. His mother's on the porch saying, "Please don't shoot him no more." They shoot. They kill him. Right. So we're making a memorial for him. We out there in this, like, real tall grass. And I turned to Brother to General, just me and him. We raking and stuff. I said, Brother General, I said, Brother, I'm just thinking, you organize black workers. And it's always, I said, black workers in the 60s and 70s. You organizing homeless black folks in the 80s. I said, General, now you organizing around dead black children in the late 90s. And I told you my brother's in Vietnam. You know, at that 1,000-mile stare, and General just stood on that rake. He held that rake, and I could see in his eyes he was gone. I just moved away from him till he started raking again. I can't come up. Just the profundity of it, that he never stopped organizing wherever we were. And that's what I say when these folks say, you can't do this, can't do. Don't talk to me about what works, because I'm in it to win it. Okay. Stop telling me about, you know, learn this catechism of impossibility. Got enough people talking about what you can't do. I don't come from no can't do tradition. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
Talk about what we can do, what we have done. Ain't that what God be saying? What Africans have done, Africans can do.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a living embodiment of it that should be in our own personal conversation. Don't bring me none of this. Now, I'm open for critical analysis, because critical analysis is important. But I'm not interested in this defeatism and, you know, black folks can't never do that. Tell that to some white person who taught you that, you know?
and
Richard, go ahead.
It's a group of us who enunciate that as if it's real. With
make a
all
career
this
out
history,
of it.
Mm-hmm,
yes,
which
sir.
Doesn't make no sense. And it stops from any, I think, you know, or at least I want to, you know, put this together like this, it stops from any theorizing occurring in relationship to what we can do from right now, because all you're debating is someone who's saying what we can't do or what others are not doing, which makes no sense to me.
Well, it makes good sense for white supremacists, so you don't have to worry about you actually doing anything. You know, I use the basketball analogy when you say somebody's like a self-check. You ain't got to go out there and check them. They're going to lose the ball. Something's going to happen. You know what I'm saying? But people have taught, I don't have to fear you if I already know I've got your mind and you won't even compete. So I'm not wasting my time with that. Somebody else can do that work, okay? I mean, and there's people who do engage that. But when you have productive meetings, people are doing these things. It's important that we engage that and develop it. I'm not going to the church talking trash about Jesus. I ain't going to the mosque talking trash about Muhammad. To what extent can we organize and work together with respect to this objective? But again, like I said, I'm not trying to go home with you. It's just to achieve this objective. Let me give you an example. I often tell my class on war and world politics. I say, after the wars of Italian unification, one of the Italian nationalists, his name was DeSeglio. DeSeglio says this. He says, gentlemen, now that we've made Italy, we must make Italians.
Mm.
Now that we've made Italy, we must make Italians. Because what was an Italian? Are they the Neapolitans, Romans, those blonde Italians up in the Trentino, the Sicilians? No, the state then made Italians, you see? So the people with this the defeatist attitude, someone's trained you. They trained you to focus on these types of things so they don't have to engage you. But I don't assume that that they're open to engagement anyway, you know. And that's why, again, I say the people – I talk the way I talk now because when people like General Man Kramer, good brother, just called in, when they talked when I was younger especially, I shut the hell up. I listened. I took notes, copious notes, and then put them in practice along with other like-minded people who encouraged me when I didn't have encouragement, and I did likewise, so we could make meaningful change. That's why it's so important. Folks don't understand today because they're still comparing today to 50 years ago and staying there. The 80s, we don't study, as scholars, as seriously to draw examples. The 80s, you have the most progressive period in hip-hop. You have the Reagan Revolution, the Reagan era, which is really what we're dealing with right now, the end of the Cold War. You have hip-hop. You have computers. 50 years ago, they don't have computers. And Harold Cruz is saying this in 67. If we must access the cultural apparatus, we must access media so we can educate our people and move in a way and use media to do that. He did that before there was social media. And then I got these Negroes coming up and asking me, well, what's the relevance of Harold Cruz today, though? He's saying this in 67. He said, one of our shortcomings is we don't have access to media. We got social media. I'm arguing with this activist brother. He's saying, well, you know, there's such a digital divide. You know, many black folks don't have computers. I said, they walk around with a computer every day. He said, what are you talking about? I said, it's called a cell phone. I said, how do you organize? See, this is our challenge, not to talk about what the least of those. You know, there are black folks that you can find some. I don't even explore that. The people who fought for our liberation, those who 196,000 who fought allied with the Union forces to end chattel slavery, the 200,000 in support, and the 300,000 reserve that Du Bois talks about in 1935. I'll say that to people, and they'll say, like, well, how are you going to talk about black liberation and they allied to a Union arm? I said, brother, tell me one war you know where folks don't have allies. What are you talking about? It's war, it's strategy. But then they'll talk about the Haitian Revolution, and I much respect that. But let me tell you this. There's a guy named, he was at UPenn. He wrote on the slave revolution. You know, Du Bois wrote this in 1935. But a white scholar wrote this in 2004, and he got the Pulitzer Prize for it. Du Bois' 1935, Black Reconstruction, is one of those books that's often cited but rarely read, just like Harold Cruz's Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. His name was Steve Hahn. And Hahn argues that the slave revolution during the American Civil War had greater impact than the Haitian Revolution. That's what Steve Hahn says. But Hahn largely repeats what Du Bois says, but so does Stephanie McCurry. I give these folks these references so they can see what I'm saying. During the time of the Civil War, the Confederates themselves said, our slaves are in revolt. That's a direct quote. Right. Check out Stephanie McCurry on The Awakening, and again, The Reckoning, and it's in, I think that's one of the chapters in my book to substantiate what I call a slave revolution, because I'm not for hyperbole. I'm not for exaggeration. I can demonstrate what I'm talking about.
All right. Richard, introduce them, because you passed it along to me about the paper.
Well,
hidden in plain sight. Go ahead
and as we talk, the thing that trying to make that transition. One thing I wanted to ask Dr. Henderson is the question about the opposition and theory. In that paper, and I did it because, you know, just trying to get a sense of the work and it, as you dealt with international relation, you make the point that white racism is the core of the international relations theory, that it is racist. But my question is, should we include in our theorizing the opposition of white supremacy?
Sure. And I don't say that the theory is racist. I mean, some of ours, the progenitors of some of this international race theories are black folks. The guy, Robert Vitalis, he's white. He's at Penn. I just use that to describe him. But he wrote on what he called the Howard School of International Relations. He's talking about Howard University.
Right.
And some of us have been writing about international relations. This goes back to Williams in the 19th century. Black folks writing on this subject in the modern era. So I wouldn't concede all of international relations or international relations theory to white folks, much less white racists. But it's at the core of some of their theoretical arguments. But I want to be clear: you can have a racist theoretical argument that can still be borne out empirically. I mean, you can use it. I mean, say, for example, what's his name? Won the Nobel Prize. Shockley. Shockley wins the Nobel Prize for transistors. Well, his development of working transistors. But Shockley was a white supremacist. He was a eugenicist. That don't mean transistors don't work. You can still be as racist and then propound a meaningful social theory. I think it's hard, but Immanuel Kant's theoretical arguments, they often seem to work in quotes for white supremacists. But they're geared toward white supremacists. He thought that blacks didn't have the intellect to run government. Matter of fact, he gave the instructions on the proper beating of an enslaved African. That's Immanuel Kant, the father of white ethical philosophy, mm-hmm. Western ethical philosophy of the Enlightenment era. So I want to be clear. It's just certain aspects of it, but that's not enough. I wrote this book in 2015 called African Realism.
Right.
And it's important that we devise theory that's liberating, but the liberating theory can't be or shouldn't be a wish list. We should talk about how the world works. This is when I get on some of my Afrocentric friends. I said, man, I get tired of talking to you about 21st dynasty Egypt. When are we going to talk about 21st century Africa in terms that are meaningful to Africans on the ground right now? And we have so much literature on that and some meaningful and powerful literature on that. And I think that international relations theory, there's this push to deal with the white supremacism, the sexism, the classism that's in it, so we can have a more emancipatory theoretical argument. And I argue that people like Du Bois and Locke, they proposed that. Du Bois posed one of the most prominent theses, important theses on imperialism. He argued that white labor and capital organized together in pursuit of imperialism in Africa and Asia. He argues that in 1915. This is before Lenin's thesis in 1916. This is Du Bois in 1915. So before Lenin's thesis, he ain't borrowing from Lenin. Lenin's thesis Du Bois' thesis focused on race and white supremacism, you see, and the union of white classes. It's like Lenin's going to focus on the class. He says, no, the racism fused the white laborer and the the white proletariat and the white bourgeoisie. That's what Du Bois, this is 1915. You see what I'm saying? So often people, not enough of us, I think, study these works to actually get meaningful strategies to devise programs or practices that are liberating today. But they'll just sit and talk around, they'll build too, about what black folks don't do. We only hear because of what black folks do. Can we do some more of that? That's what I was focused on.
And it was interesting in the paper that, as you mentioned about Locke, which I didn't really see, but it was interesting how you bring out that Locke really brought that race being a sociological construct,
yes.
You know, early on compared to now. You see now it being, you know, in trying to, and I like what you said, but making race invisible. Mm-hmm. Even though it's value, you know, that it is a social construct, so you don't deal with race no more. But the thing that got me that is, I think, is important, the reason why they changed up that to deal with that, and that because using race brings all these people of color from around the world focusing on this minority that is having this dominating power. In relationship to international relationship, you know,
yes.
So they had to move it. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, let me assert this, and let me come back to Dusk of Dawn. But remember, Locke was as integrationist as you can get. You know,
right.
Locke, he caught a lot of flack because he was gay. He caught a lot of flack. He was the first black Rhodes scholar. Locke was a brilliant philosopher. And Locke was a Phi Beta Sigma. He was a Sigma, and he gave a speech saying how proud he was when they brought their first white person into the frat. Now check this out. Locke gives this thesis at the YMCA in D.C., and then it's a series of lectures at Howard's. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Stewart has just wrote an excellent, it's a Pulitzer Prize winning biography of Locke, 900 pages. Jeffrey Stewart out of UC Santa Barbara. But check this out. Locke is the first to demonstrate that race is a social construct. Now follow me here. He says race is a social construct. It has no biological or anthropological basis. You see? Then he says this. He says, but it's useful. He done jettisoned the concept. He says it's still necessary to develop what he calls secondary race consciousness, which is the consciousness of people who are oppressed because of their race. That's Locke, the most integrationist of integrationists. He says, yeah, race is a social construct, but we still need it. And especially the organized black folk. That's what he's talking about. Now Locke, by 1925, the new Negro, he's his less radical self. Nope, I'm taking that one. I'm taking 19, That's the one I'm taking. Because I say I'm not trying to write his biography. And part of our the difficulty of scholarship, we have so many historians. Historians like to find unique things, things that they'll say can't be replicated. I'm a social scientist. We like to see patterns and generalizations. You see, what strategies most often win in war, as opposed to the particularity of the Franco-Prussian War. See, so I say I jumped to Dusk of Dawn. This is to your question, brother. Du Bois engages this in Dusk of Dawn. This was his first or his second autobiography. I had to live long enough to have. I think he had three. Anyway, in Dusk of Dawn in 1940, he says, or it's 44, he says, my paraphrase, remember, Du Bois is the first to conduct quantitative analysis in sociology, his Philadelphia Negro. That's 1899, right. The first quantitative treatment of social phenomena, not among black people, period, and the first sociological work in the U.S. That's why at Michigan they teach us quantitative analysis, and that's one of the reasons why I'm flexible in what I do. My religion book is heavily quantitative. I have a co-author for that, too. It's heavily quantitative. This one's not. Only numbers are page numbers in the book today. But this is Du Bois. Du Bois says he thought if he could just amass enough evidence through this inductive process to amass enough evidence, white folks would see the futility and the faultiness of white supremacism. They would see, because they would see the value of blacks. They'll see the importance of it. So this was his Atlanta studies. 1940, and then he says this. This is still my paraphrase, but it comes close to it. He said he thought that he could confront power with this evidence. And he says, with this truth, okay? He says, then he realized when power is confronted with truth, power will make its own truth. And that's the colonization of knowledge that you brothers have been talking about. That's the lies told as truth and made manifest. That's the catechism of impossibility that people are taught, the sense of their minorityhood, the sense that they have made no contributions to humanity. That's what, because power can do that, just like Trump is doing. You see what's in front of you. Well, you can make that. Okay. No, you don't see what you see. You'll believe me or your lying eyes. Well, this is what so much of that scholarship is, and that's what I challenge consistently and been taught to challenge.
And that's what I see, you know, in another part of it with this indirect rule, because it made me think as I was going through it, what we see visibly now in international relationship about Venezuela. I mean, they're actually creating a bipolar political system. They just had the conference in the coal area. I can't think of it now. But and they bring the guy who they, I mean, he just made himself. I mean, there's not even people are voting for Maduro, and here's this other person who's saying I am, and United States is just saying he is the ruler because we.
Richard,
you're kind of blocked out.
Yeah, Richard, yeah, okay. Say that again.
One of the points in the paper you mentioned it about indirect rule, and I was as I was reading it, I was thinking about Venezuela.
Oh yeah, I heard up to that, and about Maduro, how right, they just present him as someone.
Right, yes. And you know, in essence, or with France. The president of France said that Africans are uncivilized, and you see this tension now about, you know, the amount of money that comes out of the foreign countries that go to France, that, you know, that go to France treasury, you know, just without any colonial actor actually being in the country. I take that as the example of indirect rule and a part of this international relationship that is based off of race that has been created in the theory that, and justified in the theory they have.
Well, it's important to see this. International relations is just the study of, we sometimes call it world politics. The studies are the relations between international actors. They can be countries, or they can be cartels. They could be terrorist groups, they could be who are ever international actors. But your examples are on point. And in Venezuela, the overthrow of the Chavez, the attempted overthrow of the Chavez regime, it's ironic given our the title of the book and how we began the program, because there's an excellent piece by, there were some Irish documentarians. It's called The Revolution Will Be Televised. and they televised the coup against Chavez, right. And when the populace forced them to return Chavez to his office, they couldn't kill him. I remember after the first coup against Chavez, Condoleezza Rice went on TV and said, well, these are businessmen who want to reclaim their country from this. Then somebody reminded her that the U.S. was subject to the Treaty of the Organization of American States. And so she said that on Friday or Saturday, on the weekend. By Monday, she was saying, oh, and of course, we respect the democratically elected leadership of Venezuela. But she had just endorsed the coup project but called them businessmen. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So this is because white supremacism, again, don't just teach you what to think, but how to think. If the U.S. is saying this one's cool, we must be cool. No. Mm-hmm. That's why you have Iranians who still I was talking about the assassination before. But the Iranians, they don't need Americans to teach them democracy. They had democracy in 1953 under Mossadegh. But the right. U.S. and the Kermit Roosevelt and the CIA overthrew their government, just like the U.S. overthrew the government of Patrice Lumumba with the help of the Belgians. But the but what's key there is that they were democratically elected. This is 1960 when Africa had a democratic regime in Congo in 1960. You don't need to learn lessons. These folks don't have in 1960. U.S. didn't have democracy here. That's why you have a civil rights movement and a black power movement here. So it's so important to demystify this stuff. But and then demystifying the show, this is not difficult to explain what's accurate. That's not difficult. It's difficult to pontificate on lies and to expand lies, but also not to replicate what white supremacists train us to do. It's one of the liberating things Malcolm once said. And when I was little, I was scared of the dark. Malcolm said, he said, I don't accept the white man's God, and I don't accept the white man's devil. And I think the first time I heard that, I was in single digits, and I was like, hold up, you don't accept the devil? That means, there ain't no devil with the horns and stuff? So when I go in the basement at night, I ain't got to be scared of the devil, because I'm watching the Twilight Zone, others, the Night Gallery. I don't know. It was just liberating on a personal level. But on a broader sense is, you don't, white supremacism don't just leave you to just leave us just to find our own enemies. Yeah, give us enemies for ourselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, give us the enemies that serves them. That's right. Again what's so important about the slave revolution. What did they leverage? They leveraged whites in the North fighting whites in the South. Sometimes many black folks, black leaders, I should say, misconstrue the opposition to white folks. If it's one group of people white folks have killed more than black folks, it's other white folks.
Right.
So if you take them away from black folks, and you'll get Catholics and Protestants, white Catholics and Protestants fight, German fighting Irish fighting Italian. You'll see this conflict in the United States. When you look at Shays Rebellion or the Whiskey Rebellion, you'll see these things. And black folks, our slave ancestors, and some free but overwhelmingly enslaved. They strategize knowing that if they're so strong, solidified, you get them fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
See, and that's what I ain't got time to be talking about. But you know what? We black people, we just never come together. We just never come. No, don't talk to the white supremacists who trained you to think that way. Because if we was that, we'd still be enslaved. We freed ourselves. That's what we did. We allied with the Union Army that then betrayed us in Reconstruction. But check this out, brother. Your brother's from Philly. You know, Smoking Joe Frazier. They got Joe don't even have a statue there. That's shameful.
Well, they got a Rocky statue,
there, but Joe, if you win the heavyweight championship like Joe Frazier, if you're the heavyweight champion and you win it in the ring, then on your way home, you get robbed by somebody with a AR-15 or a Uzi, and they physically take your belt. You know, you still the heavyweight. You still won. Sometimes folks look at the Civil War, and because we lose Reconstruction, they forget that we won the war. We won that. And why are we encouraged to forget that we won so we won't draw lessons from it? And this book is about how – and Malcolm, man, people who know me, they know Malcolm. Malcolm is just one of the greatest revolutionaries produced by this country. My critique is of Malcolm's thesis. You see? But I think it's one that I could bring to him. Never met him. But I know a lot of people who did organize with him, from Emeryo Bedelli, Queen Mother, and so many, including Muhammad Ahmed. could come and say, this is what I built on your thesis. What do you think? Stop telling me what other folks have done. What do you do? How do you build and advance black liberation right now? I ain't got time to talk to you about what some Negroes ain't doing and what this one ain't doing. And they often will talk trash about folks they think won't bring them opposition. You'll talk about Christian preacher pimps, won't talk about Muslim preacher pimps, or Yoruban preacher pimps, or even some of the white preacher pimps. Constantly want to pick on the church. And the church compared to who? Say, church ain't doing enough. Compared to who? The unions? Are you serious? Are you serious?
Before
the Abyssinian Baptist Church, they feeding 14,000 hungry black kids, black people a week. 14,000. And you telling me about the Panthers free breakfast program from 50 years ago?
We're in Congress.
You got nothing for these people who feeding black hungry? Nothing? I'm not saying they the Panthers from 50 years. I didn't say that. I'm saying there's something there you can build on. You can build with. Get tired of being around faithless Negroes constantly telling you what we can't do. We are our own worst enemy. Are you serious? We're not even supposed to be here. And we ain't here for the good graces of white people.
We're in conversation tonight with Dr. Earl A. Henderson. The book, The Revolution Will Not Be Theorized, Cultural Revolution in the Black Power Era. We're going a little over tonight. We'll go to about 9:15. I want to thank the audience from the Black Talk Radio Network. It's another program coming on New Abolitionist Radio. If you still want to catch the remainder of the program, you can switch over to your app on your radio app, or switch over to timeforanawakening.com. But again, I want to thank the audience on the Black Talk Radio Network that we simulcast on. It's a program coming on at 9 o'clock, New Abolitionist Radio with Scotty Reed. We're going to continue. About 15 minutes left in the program, and we do have a call waiting, and I'm going to get right to them right now. Let's go to 646. 646? 646.
Wait a minute.
You're you're a little too close on your mic. Step back a little bit or your phone. Go ahead.
I just got a question for the brother. East
Atlanta? Yes, but I'm hearing every third word. Can you get a better connection?
Hold on 1 second. Let me.
No. Do me a favor. Call right back. See if you can hang up and call right back. While we're waiting on the caller. Professor Henderson, yes. Richard asked about that indirect rule. And it was kind of interesting, the little portion that.
Yeah, is this better, Elliot?
Yes. Yeah, I can hear you a little bit better. Go ahead.
Okay, listen. I just wanted to ask the brother a quick question. What is to be gained by the revolution?
Is that the question to me?
Yes.
Well, I wouldn't say the revolution. I was talking about the revolutionary struggle in the 1960s. A revolution shouldn't be fetishized. It's not like it's the objective, like the apocalypse for Christians. If your liberation, and that's what it's for, to live in a full and unfettered democracy, political, economic, and social democracy, then if revolution is a tool to get you there, then that's what you pursue. If reform is a tool to get you there, then that's what you pursue. It's simply a mechanism to achieve human emancipation. In that context, we mean political, economic, and social democracy in its fullest sense.
Now, could that be achieved for black folks here in America after we've been here for so long and been mistreated, and the majority of our people are looking to integrate into whiteness? Could that be achieved?
I didn't get the last part about integrated into whiteness, but I think I heard the first part. Well, Malcolm and many of the members of the Black Liberation Struggle seem to think that, and I agree with it.
Seem to think what, sir?
What you just said, could it be achieved in the context of the United States? Yes. In fact, the reason we have a conception of functioning system without chattel slavery is just because black folks fought to eradicate it. We've already changed the system dramatically. The system was built on chattel slavery. We are property. We changed that.
Yeah, but has the system placed us in a position of sovereignty?
I'm not hearing all of it. Has the system done what, brother?
Has it placed us in sovereignty, in a position to be able to govern ourselves?
I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, I just did. I just did.
Okay, thank you, Elliot.
Mm-hmm.
Has the system placed us in a position to be able to govern ourselves? And the reason why I said this is because a couple of weeks ago we had a little discussion in regards to this so-called movement that the Nation of Islam, Dr. Abel Muhammad, is pushing about separation of elves, asking the United States government to give us some land to, I guess, govern ourselves, to build, grow, and develop?
Well, I would encourage you to read the section on the Republic of New Africa, who's probably gone further to making these questions about reparations and land. But if the question's about, first of all, if the question's about sovereignty, all the black folks weren't, or the major black folks weren't fighting for sovereignty somewhere. But if you talk about liberation in the context where we started with in the discussion and black nationalism, that suggests that you can have an autonomous polity within a larger federated union. It's the limit. The limit is your, in that sense, almost your imagination. But if it's not whether, I don't know what you mean by the system will allow this. We have carved out a space for us where we're 40 million. We're not supposed to be here. We're 4 million in 1860. We're 40 million now. We have transformed this government. One of the biggest things that white supremacism has done is to convince us that we have no victories. The reason you have this industrial powerhouse of the U.S. is because of black folks, our struggles in enslavement, and to transform it. Any meaningful sense of democracy we created in this country. So if the question is, do we have the capacity to make changes further, even towards some full liberation, I would say yes. And it's not a hope, it's on the evidence of what we've already changed.
But don't you realize through your studies and your understanding of white supremacy is that it's the job of the white man to put us and keep us in this position that we're in today? Why would he ever allow us to truly be independent here, to be able to govern ourselves, to be able to secure ourselves safety based on what they did when we were, as some say, our economic peak with Rosewood, Tulsa, and all the other places where we independently set up our own existence from coming out of his enslavement? See, I think one of the things that we make a mistake on is the romanticism that if we do certain things, white folks will just leave us alone.
Well, when you say allow us, what do you mean white folks will allow us?
Well, like he's saying, because they've gone from 4 million to 40 million, that we have supposedly progressed to the point to where as they haven't eliminated us.
So brother, you infer a lot from things said and unsaid. My example is the slave revolution. Would you agree? I try to have a dialogue. Would you agree that we don't face conditions today anywhere comparable to what our people faced in 1860? Would you agree with that?
I would agree that we don't, but I would also say this, that the assault on us has just developed on a whole nother level. But I don't think we as a people are totally better off other than not facing the type of brutality that we faced while we were enslaved. As far as the same type of situations that are different and matured upon, keeping us oppressed as a people, keeping us divided, and keeping our loyalty to them, it's just gotten better.
I think we have a fundamental disagreement. I commend to you Edward Baptiste, the half that's not been told if you think we are comparable or anywhere near what we faced in 1860,
I don't think that we made a revolution. On a certain level.
But brother, you keep qualifying it. It's a simple question. Are we better off today than we were in 1860? If we can't find common ground on that, we probably can't find common ground. And that's cool, too, because that rational people disagree is no biggie.
No. We can find common ground that we are better off on certain levels. I would agree with you.
What is about certain level, on any level, compared to 1860? That is, you're not only enslaved, your child. They don't go to the hospital. They go back to the slave master. If we can't agree on basic things, then we don't have a common ground, and that's okay. This is why I started off the discussion saying I'm not a big on unity. I'm interested in working on people. I know the language you're speaking is what we call fatalism. What can be done? How can we do it? I think if you study it, you'll see the way we got our liberation before, just like my analogy of the heavyweight fight, is the way you can build on. I didn't say it's the way you replicate it. That's over 100 years ago. But strategies, just like balance of power strategy is still used today. That goes back to Mencius, Cortelia, and Thutmose. But it's still used today, the logic of it. The strategy that was used with respect to organizing, not just the Underground Railroad, but the actual fighting, 196,000, 186,000 in the Union Army, 10,000 in the Union Navy. Not just Robert Smalls, his navigation, but those 10,000 sailors. When white folks were against us from both sides, okay, including the President of the United States, what did we do? I would encourage you to study that before we have this fatalistic argument about, well, we can't do it. They won't allow us to do it. You think they allowed to end the slavery? You think they allowed? You think they allowed 500,000 Africans to fight for their liberation and achieve? We don't have to use the language of allowing. Let's talk strategy there. So the question becomes:
two people can't talk at the same time, Jay.
Would you say this, that they knew that they had to do something in regards to slavery once they saw that they was about to be defeated?
Brother, will you accept that? First of all, there's not a monolith they. Okay, that's what I said. That's why I keep bringing up the Civil War. White folks killed more white folks in the Civil War, okay? There's no they, okay? That's part of the camouflage to make your adversary seem more powerful than they actually are. Okay, that's one. The other is the strategy that was used. What was the strategy used to leverage so that white folks were fighting white folks as black folks were fighting overwhelmingly Confederates for their own liberation, defeating their old slave masters, using techniques? Now, if I said something like, well, Mao Zedong often has a chapter talking about your enemy as source of supply, they're like, oh, some guerrilla warfare. Yeah, that's been tried out. That's been practiced. No. But if I'm talking about black folks strategizing in the land underneath our feet, I got to defend. Why would I draw on that? They created a situation where we can even have this phone conversation. That's black folks. And you ask me what black folks can do? They have transformed what we knew of this society. So for us, today I would argue, as Harold Cruz argued, to control, use the media, to leverage the media, this before we had social media, to do what? To organize towards certain cultural issues that would, what he called, ramify, that would spin off into economic and political ones. Don't go straight for the economic or political ones. You don't have as much leverage there. Where do we have leverage? Culture. We can produce that. We can use that because we can generate that autonomously, ourselves. Don't go to the, he said, he'll say you don't have to. I'm sorry, he doesn't say you must. But he said don't start with the economic or the political because you'll generate opposition and unify white folks. Start on the culture part.
I totally agree with you because I feel that's what Max A. Kong did. I believe was one of his key components of how he was able to have the revolution that he was able to do. So we in agreement on that.
Okay, well, thanks for your call in, brother.
Who did he refer to? I didn't hear you.
He said Mao Zedong.
Mao Zedong. Well, that kind of makes my point. You can see Mao Zedong, but you can't see American revolutionaries right here. Probably some of them in Pennsylvania. Not probably. Some of them in Pennsylvania themselves. Because we're not taught to educate ourselves on what's actually liberating for us. Mao Zedong is organizing a revolution in a third world country against opposition that was so insipid. Chiang Kai-shek, who's a murderous dictator, who doesn't even fight or barely fights against the Japanese. He rarely killed communists. Mao Zedong argued in the 1960s that whites in America were not racist. I cited it in the book. He said the white workers weren't, only the bourgeoisie. The white workers weren't racist? They're huge white supremacists. So folks will study Mao Zedong because they're trained to respect that, but they won't study our much less William Webb or the theorists of Nat Turner. You know, Nat Turner, if he would have made it, he was a bridge away from getting to the Dismal Swamp. They'll phrase him as a crackpot. He organized. The reason why he's using knives and pieces of wood at night, because he doesn't want to wake anyone with gunfire. You see? He starts. They meet. It's about 2, 3 in the morning. But when day breaks, he puts red bandanas on them, get horses, and they charging to study Nat Turner. But if I teach you that he's a crackpot interested in getting a white woman, then you won't even go there looking for your liberation. You won't go and study Denmark Vesey. You won't go and study Charles Dillon. You won't go and study Gabriel. But you quote Mao Zedong.
Wow.
I'm not saying you shouldn't quote Mao Zedong, brother. I'm saying for liberation here, I think it's straightforward logic to say, shouldn't we draw on the last revolution that was successful here? And that was the slave revolution during the U.S. Civil War. That's what I'm saying. I teach. And I know a little about Mao Zedong and the Chinese Revolution, but appreciating that and appreciating revolution in general, the revolution right under our feet is what so many folks missed and unfortunately continue to.
Let's grab one last call before we break. Let's.
I guarantee to have. I promise a short response.
Let's go to 215. 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. And hello to your distinguished guest. How you doing, my brother? Hi, Brother Richard. How you doing, good brother? How you feeling? Join the conversation tonight, my brother. All praise be to Allah. I just want to say I had a meeting, brother, Dr. Ahmed.
I think you could, do you have a radio up in the background?
It's probably that TV and stuff. I'm sorry. Let me turn it down. I apologize for that, brother. That's my bad. I didn't mean to have it too loud and stuff. I was talking about Kobe Bryant. I had it a little too loud. But anyway, my condolences out to Kobe Bryant and his family as well. But yeah, I had the honor of meeting Dr. Ahmed, during the time he was living and stuff. I met him on a few occasions. He was a beautiful brother, as you say, a good brother. He was a good brother. He was, I just sat and listened to the man talk about his relationship with Brother Malcolm and everything. And I was just mesmerized. I've seen him talked to him on a few occasions, and his knowledge about our people and his knowledge about Malcolm and everything, it just had me just mesmerized listening to him. And I think it made me a better person listening to him, because here's somebody that knew Malcolm on a personal level, you know what I mean? So I was just glad to meet the brother, you know what I mean? And see, one thing I learned, brother, is I don't claim to know it all. I listen and stuff. And if I'm wrong, I'm man enough to come and admit that I'm wrong. I don't try to be a know-it-all. I don't try to overtalk people. But when I believe in something, I'm gonna stand up for what I believe in. And I'm like you. I could disagree with somebody respectfully. Like I said, I don't have to know. I can disagree with Elliot or Richard or you or anybody else. But I can disagree respectfully. I'm not gonna try to call you a Negro or a handkerchief, because we might just have a principal disagreement. But I love what you're saying tonight, brother. I like your rap. I like your spirit. And I love your love for our people and stuff. Because everything that you said tonight, I agree with. I didn't find anything that I disagree with, brother. I just want to say that in closing. That's all. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing, brother, and thank you for a principal engagement. I'm trying to do the same, brother.
Thank you
your
call,
brother. Peace and blessings.
Right.
And to you as well.
Let's go to 404-404.
Hey, Brother Edler, you hear me? Y'all hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hey, man, good show. To your guest, man, I like the way you think, man. Because me, I stopped using that word can't, won't, and don't like a couple of years ago, man. And you right on the money, man. It's all about, we got to make a simple paradigm shift on the words we use, all right? For instance,
yes,
I hear on show after show, these Negroes talking about you want to hide something from black people, put it in the book. That's a damn lie right there. Because I found out that damn devil, Jimmy Ulysses S. Grant, okay, during the time you talk about, during the Civil War, that Ulysses S. Grant, in his own words, said, I quote, okay, when he walked into the colored barracks, okay, when the black Union colored troops were not fighting, they was relaxing, he said every damn one of them had a book in their hand and a piece of paper and a writing utensil, man. Okay? That's in the Union War.
Yes, sir.
You see what I'm saying, my brother?
Yes, sir.
So that's...
I think, brother, when I say we're the only ones threatened with death to learn how to read and write, I guess some black folks just imagine that then white folks taught us to read and write. No, that was us. We devised that way. We devised it. We made the basis for what then would become public education. You know the logic why you got public education? Because they said, look here, well, if the Negroes got it, and you know they didn't call us Negroes, if the Negroes got it, hell, everybody can get it. Cruz talks about that in the Blair bill. White folks actually in the Blair bill, they rejected the Blair bill, which would have given public education to everyone because it would also give public education to black folks. So how do they think we did this? They think it's just, you know, well, just white folks allowed us to do this. See, this is how white supremacism, I say it again, will not just teach you what to think, it'll teach you how to think. How can I sit up and talk about a black revolution and one that was successful and everybody and their mama know they didn't teach the Civil War like that to us? And many people, they'll reject it. They're hearing it tonight. They can't. They have to tell them, okay, read Steve Hahn. That's why I say the white guy wanted to pull a surprise. He said the same thing in 2004. Mm-hmm. He got to pull a surprise for it. Du Bois writes it in 1935. Mm-hmm. Like, no. Negroes did not do that. No. This is the power of it. And just like you say, they don't have to hide it in the book. We studied it. And King said this. Jump to 1968. Read King's last Sunday sermon. It's called Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution. Is that a hell of a title? Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution. He says these words exactly. I teach this in my class. And I teach my class. These are international relations class. He says these words. Racism is a way of life for the vast majority of white Americans. Racism is a way of life, a small part, a way of life. Okay, for a few races in the South, the vast majority of white Americans. 1968, that's King. King says, now my paraphrase, that blacks, once these opportunities were open to them with the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, blacks have made a concerted effort to study and learn. And he listed history, economics, all this. He said, I don't see a similar effort among white folks. We have studied these things. It don't just apply to basketball and music, to sports and music, if you will.
I agree with you, man. I agree with you wholeheartedly, man, because the number one issue we got now is repeating this white supremacy crap on each other, man. By ridiculing and downgrading each other, man. Okay,
and not even studying it.
Yes, sir.
That's why. That's why I talk about being raised in the projects. I don't need no. What kind of lessons folks got? We was poor, and this is what we did. You know what I'm saying? It's like when we was organized with the gang. They said, "Well, Brother Earl, see, you got to know. You know, folks. We call it rolling in Detroit. So folks sell dope to make money." I said, "No, they don't." See, I say I'm a project, I wouldn't say Negro. You know the word I say. I'm trying to repeat on your show. I say I'm a project. I say people don't sell dope to make money. People sell dope to make quick money. There's a difference. When they say, well, you know, brother ain't going to go out and work, you know, minimum wage job. Who the hell you think working minimum wage job? Had a minimum wage job, I was 14 years old. You see what I'm saying? So we talk about what is the strength of black communities. That's why I don't like when they talk about what's a black issue and they immediately start talking about prisons. What's a black issue? No, I'm saying. No, I'm not talking. We already talk about missing political prisons. Don't get it twisted. But I'm saying when we would organize in the prison, one of the first things I would say when I go into place, I say there's a lot of folks, and I talk about political prisoners, and I run the list. I say, but most of y'all ain't political prisoners. I say I know a bunch of y'all, and I would just start naming because they're from the projects, like me. You know what I'm saying? I say, but you ain't here to do your time. You just say trying to get no guard putting another ticket on you because they don't like you, or they try to put a ticket on me as I was leaving because I had on sweatpants and gym shoes. That's how I came. You know what I'm saying?
So some
of us who know these games and stuff and who've been able to access higher education, we got to demystify. We ain't got to. You do what you want. But for me, I'm trying to demystify this stuff to make it plain. That's why that book, and we made the book free. You can check it out online. I hope brothers and sisters and folks who ain't brothers and sisters will read it and study it. But there's a strategy there that we gleaned from the Black Power Movement, and I think it's worth reflecting on. That's all I'm saying. I ain't doing no religious stuff. I ain't trying to teach nobody no way of life. But I'm saying there's a strategy that comes out of there. I think it's worth reflecting.
Brother West, thank you for your contribution.
One more thing, man.
Go ahead.
To quote a great scholar that's on the program, he said a couple of weeks ago, hey, we got to stop being in competition with each other. Ain't no damn competition. This year at war. We at war against the damn enemies that done fucked our mind. Excuse my friend. But you know what I'm talking about, Elliot. Okay? When the dude talking about we in competition. We not in competition with each other, man. Okay? We like a fish. We finna ball up and change the whole paradigm shift of our mind, free our mind, and our gluteus maximus will follow. I appreciate the show, Elliot. Good show. And I hope my brother put his information out so I can get his book. Appreciate it.
Talk to you.
Yes, sir.
interesting conversation tonight, Professor Henderson.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much.
I promise I don't talk this loud all the time, but I told you there's so many. I had to holler just to get my voices heard, just to get some food.
Well, listen, before go ahead, Rich.
Saying that is so powerful and important.
Before you leave us, and before you give out any information, how people can reach you or get the book, and if people write timeforawakening.com, I'll give them that link where they can. I'll email you.
Yes, sir. Because I emailed it to you.
Yes.
And you can just Google me, Errol A. Henderson, and I'm at Penn State in the political science department. The book is published by SUNY Press. But again, if you Google me. And even put the revolution will not be theorized. You can find your way to the link where you can get it. You can read the whole thing free online, and I think that's the easiest way. And again, I sent the link while we were talking to you, Brother Elliot, while we were talking.
Good. Okay.
I sent it again.
Right.
When I say the link, it's the link to the free one. Now, please just distribute it. You however you like, however you like.
Okay.
And anybody who tack on to that, they can start reading it chapter by chapter. Just scroll down on it, and you'll see it has the whole everything. The whole book is in there.
Now, the other book that's that you have scheduled for release this month, Scriptures.
Oh, they pushed it back to March. That's published by University of Michigan Press.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Now that's a quantitative analysis of the role of religion in international relations. I've done with the co-author Zev Miles, and we put together this data set on the religious characteristics of all the countries in the global system from 1940 to 2010. So that's more a quantitative analysis to see what factors increase the probability of war. For example, do states that are – the countries that are religiously different, are they more or less likely to fight? States with religious diversity, are they more likely to have civil war, things like that? So, but we also look at international cooperation as well, which ones are more likely to cooperate with each other, and also quality of life. So you can go up to University of Michigan's webpage. Again, if you put my name in the Google search – you'll find it. That's the book that'll be out. It's scheduled for March 4th, but it'll also be free as well. You'll be able to access it free because you take care of that during the when you're getting a contract for a book. At least at my level, you do.
Okay. Listen,
when I say at my level, I mean I'm not like a Dyson. Dyson gonna get an advance. I ain't mad. I'm just describing. He'll get an advance for a book. You know what I'm saying? I'm just you know, don't nobody know me. You know what I'm saying? So that's what I mean. But no disrespect, man. I'm just describing.
Hey, look, it's real.
Yeah, he's from Detroit too. Dyson's from Detroit too. I ain't mad at him.
We'll reach out to you once.
Well, okay, some of the things I'm mad at, but we won't go.
That's another story for another day.
Yes, sir.
We'll reach out to you when it's released, and we can kick that around a little bit also.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you, two brothers, so much for all the work you're doing. I've been listening to some of the older shows and stuff so I can, you know, get hip to what y'all are doing. And I got to get down to Philly more, and it's a – man, it's a blessing to have you all out there doing the kind of work you're doing.
And the next time you come on, we can talk about that letter to Penn State you did.
Oh. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I know that. You talk about a story. I had just got finished telling somebody, his son has played ball, and one of the places, might have been considered is Penn State. And I said, I don't think so.
Well, that's why they love me here. They really like me here.
but I'm glad they got there to do the work,
Yeah, and listen, the last sentence on the bio talked about challenging white supremacy, and you put it at the academic level. But we have to become activists, all of us, and challenge white supremacy at every level. And it takes organizing to do it. I mean, you were an organizer with coming up in college, and that's why I talked about the skill, and I wanted to kind of go down that path with you, but we can do that another time. It takes skill to organize people. You know this as an organizer. So in order to do this, it's good that we challenge it on individual levels because it's excellent, especially if somebody has a bully pulpit. But the most of us that don't, I think that we have to organize and challenge these things at every level. And the blueprints
of it. Yes, sir. And to bring the people into it to show them how they're making these positive contributions in what they're doing already.
Okay.
I think this is the key, to not be either or. It's just to do what you can do while you're doing what you do.
Okay.
See, because that's a key. Because that's a key to strategy as well. Imagine if you think in revolution while doing what you're doing, you see? So when people just want to give, we all don't need to be in the street. We all don't need to be in the formal organization. It may be more advantage not to be in that organization, you see?
Okay.
So there's a range of strategy. And once you start talking strategy, it liberates us to think about objectives in a broader sense and to think about techniques in a broader sense. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. To keep folks, no, we want to keep you right at that work you do at the soup kitchen. We want you right there. We want you right there. Keep doing that good work you're doing. Because we know certain people who come there. We know it's serious when you look at this as something that's transformative and how it was done before. That's so important, to learn our lessons.
Professor Henderson, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll talk soon.
Thank you so much for having me, dear brothers.
All right.
Take care.
Peace. Richard, it was a good program today, and I like the information.
Yes, being able to be an academic and be an activist and be clear is really an art. You know, you say about the skill, but it's our art. It's that in between thing where you can do it, everybody can do it, but everybody can't do it the same way. And Brother Henderson obviously was able to bring all of those things together.
And, you know, one of the things he mentioned that we've talked about on the program is we all need to do something if we can work at our level. He used another term. If you're in the kitchen, soup kitchen or whatever, keep doing your work there. It's the same thing. We got to get busy doing something to fight the situation we're in. And it's kind of ironic, Richard, because I noticed this when guests come on, and especially guests that are activists. And when I say activists, doing something, they always seem to know other people that's doing something.
Mm-hmm.
When he talked tonight, he mentioned about four or five people that he's either worked with, respect their work, combined efforts with them, and at least four or five of them people that he mentioned have been on the program at one time or another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that I do love about what we do. We try to showcase our people from all over this country that's trying to do something, not trying, doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of these people are doing it, and it's important that people know what they're doing. So we have them on. And he mentioned people from grassroots, people like Maureen Taylor, to other professors like himself, James Lance Taylor. He mentioned several, but Sterling Stuckey. He mentioned several people that have been on his program. And then other people that he respect their work, like the sister that did the book about the abolitionists with guns.
Mm-hmm.
So, the struggle continues. That's all I can say. And we just got to be a part of it. Before we leave tonight, want to give the lineup on Time for an Awakening. It's been some changes because this year it's going to be a few programs added and some that are no longer doing their program. But, you know, that's what we're going to do. We're going to move forward. And you know, this thing is always open. You can email us at the timeforanawakening.com if you have a show idea, a program idea, a message that you want to get out, you've been doing research on, you got things that you want to bring forward in a program setting, you can always do that. Just email us at timeforanawakening.com. We'll sit down and conversate, and then maybe we can move forward. It's a couple new programs that will be coming on soon. It's one that's added, Esoteric Conversations with Sister Marcy, that's been added on Friday. And I think she'll be expanding her program soon, but I'll be in conversation with her. But let me give the lineup before I leave. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshie, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Always interesting dialogue on African Perspectives with Brother Oshie from 6 to 8 on Monday evenings. Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed, Last Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8 on time for An Awakening Media. Every first and third Monday is Conversation Reparations from 9 to 10 on time for An Awakening Media. On Tuesday, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on time for An Awakening. And we jump to Friday from 1 to 2, or possibly 1 to 3. We'll see what we get it to do. Esoteric Conversations with Sister Marcy. Interesting program. She's been doing it now for a couple of weeks, and it's really taken off. Her audience is widening. And then Friday evenings, back, myself and Richard, on time for An Awakening at 8 o'clock. Again, we got some new programs being added, and you can always be a part of what we do. Just email us at timeforanawakening.com and propose to us your program idea, and then we can move forward. The Black Talk Radio Network is planning a telethon coming up soon, Richard, to let people know about what's going on and the need for our people to donate to whatever we're doing, whether it's a dollar, 50 cent. Give something to help the efforts of what's being done, because all of this stuff has a cost to it, and it's just the reality of it. You know, if we're talking about us freeing our minds and working with one another in a communal effort, all of this stuff falls in line with what we're trying to do as a people. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion. As always, I will be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware of, I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of.
save the children, to save the children.